Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. This is class 2 of 32 of our structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. This is the second talk on the introduction. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So this morning's talk is the second talk on the rather long introduction to our 16-week, 32-class study of Vipassana, a study of introspective insight into the three marks of existence, Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. So that central part, the Anatta, the not-self characteristic, is where all of the Dhamma resolves. The Buddha's Dhamma is about establishing a true and skillful understanding of what a human being is, what it actually is, in relation to the world around it, an impermanent world. It's a lack of understanding of self in relation to its environment that results in clinging to impermanent phenomena, resulting in suffering. Does everybody see those three marks in there?
Yes.
And Regina, I know this might be a little bit too out of context for you, but what I'm talking about basically is what an awakened human being understood. He was called the Buddha after he awakened, which simply means an awakened human being. What he understood is that the whole problem of human suffering arises from ignorance of the way the world actually is. And if you think a little bit about that, it makes sense. Any subject or anything that you're involved in, if you don't understand what's going on, it's going to be very frustrating and cause stress for you. So because of a lack of understanding, ignorance of what actually constitutes a human being, clinging to impermanent phenomena results in suffering. The not-self-characteristic, the impermanent environment, and that suffering. It's all a matter of clinging to these wrong views in relation to the world we live in that ends up in stress and suffering. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Okay, I did a pretty good job. I know these are abstract ideas until you actually experience that, but that's the point of these teachings, and it's helpful to get it on the record here too. One of the reasons why this introduction in two parts, I think the whole introduction is just under 5,000 words. Not that the size is important, but the reason why I'm going through the entire introduction is really twofold. One is that everyone here, with the exception of Regina, has heard most of the references here before. In other words, it's very repetitive. But as the Buddha teaches, that without repetition, there's no Dhamma. But the bigger picture is as an introduction, I'm trying to present a very broad and very general overview of what we'll be studying in the next 30 classes. And so this really is a just that. It's a broad and general introduction to everything we're going to be studying. And it starts bringing into context the Buddha's teaching with a specific view of developing this particular introspective insight. In other words, we're now going to take the suttas that we all know, with the exception of Regina, that we've heard over and over again, and we're going to go through them, and I'll speak to them, I'll teach them, but with the holding in mind that we are using these suttas for this very specific insight. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully we're going to see things in a slightly deeper and more well-focused way than we have over the last bunch of years. We're ready for this as a Sangha. And Tommy understands all. I'm sure you do, Tommy. You understand the context, right?
I do.
Good. And anybody, including, please, Regina, if I'm saying anything that seems ridiculous to you, just please ask me to clarify. So this is part two. The other thing that I would like to stress, that it would take way too long and be too broken up if I taught the same class on Tuesdays and Saturdays. Even though we are, for the most part, two distinct groups, you could even say two distinct sanghas, with the exception of Lorna and Kevin. most of you come either on Tuesdays or Saturdays. Some of you don't. Tim comes on on Tuesdays too. This is a complete teaching, and the way I structured it is 1 week leads to the next week, et cetera, et cetera. And so each week builds towards this understanding. So to get the most out of this study, if you can't make it to each and every class, which I don't expect many of you can, please try to listen to the recording or watch the video. And last week's is up there. And I'll usually get these posted within 24 hours of a class. Okay. So this is part two of the introduction. The subtitle is Developing Useful and Skillful Insight. This is getting down to the heart of it. This may be out of context because I realize that I think Lorna, Kevin, and Tim have heard the Tuesday class. I don't know if any of you all else had. It should stand on its own, but I would ask you to go back and listen to that just so we get this in context moving forward. It is only from a well-focused and authentic Dhamma practice that the skillful disciple is able to recognize, interrupt, and finally abandon all conditioned views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It is the Eightfold Path the Buddha taught that provides the necessary framework and guidance for well-focused introspective insight into this self-created feedback loop. And though many of you what I'm referencing is the Nagara Sutta, where the Buddha describes his own awakening. And key and crucial to his awakening was recognizing, and this is really where the brilliance of the Siddhartha Gautama comes through, recognizing that he was stuck in this feedback loop of ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of the way things are, reverberating or constrained by self-referential views. The Pali word for that is namarupa, name and form. It means this strong self-identification by clinging to fabricated phenomena, a fabricated view of phenomena, rooted in that initial ignorance, creates this internal feedback loop that continually obscures reality. And so stress can only follow from that. Is that relatively clear?
Yeah.
And that's the problem. That is the core problem, because there's no one to blame, there's no system to blame, there's no God to blame, there's no parents to blame, there's no siblings, poverty, great wealth, there's nothing to blame for the fact that we have found ourselves rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It's simply the way of the world. It's just the way it is. Dukkha occurs. The Buddha realized that, in the brilliance of this man, what he realized is just that, that we simply don't understand who we are in relation to the world. So he spent 45 years teaching us how to gain that understanding. And again, that all resolves itself the only place it can, within a self. And this is a significant difference between what the Buddha taught then and now that was 100% different than anything else that ever came before. And I would say to this day that the problem is not something external, and anything that is used to appease or gain merit externally to hope to establish myself in a better situation in the future is obviously an external speculated view. It's not resolving here where the problem is. It's creating an abstraction of where I hope to be, and that is constant grasping, isn't it? If I do a certain number of things, if I follow the Ten Commandments, if I bow enough, if I chant enough, if I do this, if I visualize the right God or Deva, etc., etc., at some point, it's usually presented that endless eons into the future, you might be okay. The Buddha never taught anything like that. That's constant grasping after speculated views. Everything resolves within the self, so that the ultimate resolution then is understanding what constitutes a self in relation to its environment. Sorry to not take your question immediately.
Just what you've touched on there, I know you touched on the, and you often say that from name and form we go no further and it loops back on ourselves. I kind of get that, but I kind of don't get that.
Thank you.
In the broad sense, I kind of get it. but I really don't really get it deeply, get it.
So, thank you. It's such an important question. Notice a progression in dependent origination from ignorance, to fabrications, to consciousness. I think the next one is name and form. From name and form is simply, even though it has this, you know, this funny name, this Pali name, Namarupa, it simply means I've given name to the form. I've identified, this is John. And that's the initial problem, because this isn't John, is it? This is something that's in a continual state of hopefully mindfulness of what's occurring. But the form isn't me. And as soon as I insist that the form is me and it's all that I am, I'm in trouble, because the form is impermanent, isn't it? And there's a deeper understanding, and when we can touch on that. But in the progression from ignorance of the way things are, I create a fabricated view. Why did I create a fabricated view? What else could I do? I don't understand what's occurring. I don't understand the nature of living in this impermanent, phenomenal world. That's the initial problem. Because of that and those fabricated views, it impacts the way that I think. Consciousness, the third link in the chain. So now my thinking, and this is just describing how this, how our thinking got so messed up, off track, out of focus is probably the best way to say that. Meaning, not focused on what's real, focused on the fabrications that I've just created. And now, because I have self-identified with a fabricated view of the world, another word for fabrications is perverted or corrupted. It's not based in reality. And it's prone to creating stress and suffering in my life. Because now I've given that conscious construct a name, I've identified with a fabrication, haven't I? You notice the progression? And now that I've identified with the fabrication, what happens to a human being who is now thinking? That name and form now has attached itself to something that has six senses, called the sixth sense base. The five physical senses and the sixth sense of consciousness. Every human being has it. Remember, this isn't some grand cosmic consciousness that resolves itself in some completely interconnected, one non-dual reality. It has nothing to do with that. That's another speculated existence, isn't it? Name and form now comes in contact with the external world, with the phenomenal world, through its senses. And remember, I'm now attached to this. Whatever is interpreted in this body is my experience. Because I'm now interpreting my experience in the world and the world at large through a fabricated view, what's going to occur? More fabricated views, more corruption of what's, a corrupted view of what's occurring. And not to go through the whole list of dependent origination, we now, that ignorance can only result in ongoing confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing and unsatisfactory experiences. Why? Because it's not based on any reality. And again, people's minds will already go, well, my life isn't always unsatisfactory. That's not what the Buddha's teaching. But it is our preoccupation with always getting what we want. Brett and I had a great conversation about this earlier. It's our preoccupation with always getting what we want and always being mindful of what we need to avoid to maintain our happiness and security that distracts us from our life. Because where is that mind? That mind, rooted in self, is either in the past or in the future. Meaning it's in the future because it's still reacting to past events. And what happens then? We spend our entire lifetimes bouncing from past to future and never right here, which is the only place that we can experience a human life, a mind united in its body. What an important question. Let me just make sure that I...
I need to listen to it. Thank you for your explanation. I know I've taken most of the time this morning.
That's what we're here for.
But thank you very much.
Yes, yeah, so, and you understand, why I keep coming back to the point of contact. It's all right here. So. Okay. Heaven.
It's almost, and maybe I'm saying this wrong, but in this study and the whole context of this, it's almost as if the Buddha is saying that anatta is name and form, and it is, I guess, but where that's established is where it all starts, because there's no sixth sense base, there's no contact, there's no feeling. If the self is not misunderstood and needed to be established, you know, it all follows yes. after that. So if you're not establishing the self from a wrong view, you don't have feeling, you don't have all that, because they're just, it's just happening, it's just occurring. And
I didn't mean to cut you
it's
off.
It's almost like
it's such an important
point.
This,
we would, in dependent origination, we would go through all 12 links, but in the study of Vipassana, as it relates to the three marks, we stop at where anatta starts from a wrong view, and it goes no further. There's nothing
That's
after that. It has to go back to anatta being established. So you're basically doing dependent origination, the first three, and it just keeps flipping back from name and form, back to ignorance, back to fabrications, back to consciousness, name and form, back to, and it's just those first four, because there's nothing after that.
That's where the focus is. But yeah, excuse me, Regina, and anybody else, just, their heads just exploded. But all of that does resolve in the last thing, in ongoing stress and suffering. That you bring up another important point. This dependent origination from ignorance resulting in 12 causative links to suffering is not something that occurs in a linear time frame that we can actually observe until we quiet our minds. And it's really not so much as picking up each step. It's simply understanding that this is from ignorance results in suffering. The declarative steps in between are simply benchmarks so we can recognize that we're doing this. Another important point that you bring up, dependent origination is the most misunderstood, misapplied, and intentionally corrupted teaching by necessity. In order to create a different dharma out of what the Buddha taught, you have to corrupt and alter dependent origination. So it's often presented that, the name is often changed to like dependent co-arising, and modern times is interdependent co-arising. Interdependent and dependent are two different words, aren't they? They have two different meanings. But yet, in order to create an ultimate non-dual speculative dharma, this has to be adapted and really discarded. This dependent origination is not a creation myth, even though it's often portrayed that way. There's nothing in it that could be misconstrued unless you corrupt it. It simply describes, outside of a human linear time frame, how suffering arises. The reason why I say that is we're not giving birth to a human being. Again, the question could be, well, where does a human being come from? The answer is, it doesn't relate to the Dhamma. We don't need to know where we came from because we're here. And unless you're an anthropologist, and human beings have an interest in where they came from, but it doesn't matter as far as Dhamma study. If you're distracted by where do I come from and where am I going, where's your thinking? It's not here. So the Buddha taught a Dhamma that resolves all human disappointment where it belongs, in the self, in the self united in its body.
But it's the understanding of that origin of suffering. And that's what we're
yes.
here for.
Yes, that, yes. That, again, that's what the Buddha's, you really understand, all of you, you understand this well, because you're describing just that. It's nothing outside of ourselves. If I'm suffering, if I'm distressed, if I'm unhappy, if I think my life isn't going the way I want it, who's responsible for the way I'm thinking and feeling?
You.
Is it even reasonable to think that that's based on anything external? I mean, the worst thing that could happen, my reaction to the worst thing that could possibly happen to me is up to me, isn't it? And that doesn't mean that we don't have any emotions. It simply means that we feel whatever is appropriate as it's occurring without reaction. We don't take it personally. And there's not one thing in the world that can occur that cannot be applied to. The Buddha teaches that as an awakened human being, we feel exactly what is appropriate to feel without the need for it to be any different. We don't lose our minds over it. We don't lose our concentration. We don't lose our bodies out of it by thinking it needs to be different by reaction. But let me continue. Okay. The Eightfold Path develops a profound understanding of the stress and suffering that follows from clinging fabricated self-referential views of self to impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas. And that's how we create an identity for ourselves. We cling ourselves to our fabricated views of the world. And again, just to make the point, it doesn't mean that what we've attached ourselves to is something that we shouldn't. It means that we simply shouldn't make the attachment, meaning whatever we find ourselves doing in our life is what we're doing. And if we're fortunate enough that it's really what inspires us, all the better. But it doesn't diminish or denigrate what we're doing. It simply means we don't use it to define who we are. Because if we happen to be the world's greatest meditation teacher, you're all fortunate. But I believe that in my own mind as who I am in the world, I'm in trouble, aren't I? Because anytime somebody's a little disappointed or doesn't seem to be getting what I'm teaching, then I blame myself. When the truth of the matter is, all I can do is the best I can do no matter what I'm doing, whether I'm still in a construction business or I decide to be a brain surgeon. If I do, please don't come to me. I don't want to do that.
We already are. You already did.
Because if I, in my mind, I think I'm the world's greatest meditation teacher, and that's the most important thing that I hold out to the world, I'm living an illusion, aren't I? Even if I happen to be, even if there's a way to quantify that. The stress I'm creating is because of my belief that I have to be that. And we tend to do that with whatever we're doing, whether it's a card player, a canasta player, or a knitter, a golfer, or whatever it is. In the moment, we have to be the best at it. And we struggle when other people might seem to be better, at least in the moment. It comes out a lot on the golf course, doesn't it? It used to drive me crazy how I used to play a lot of golf. I loved the game, still do. Wish I could still play. But that otherwise good and honest men take the game so personally that they don't think about cheating at it. And it's a game that doesn't allow itself towards cheating, ultimately. I mean, you can cheat and make yourself better, but the whole point of that particular game is that you're as good as you are, and you can't be any better. But when we're so stuck in having to be the best or better, we'll even do something as foolish as cheat at golf. Silly, isn't it? But we do that with all the things. Not just golf, I'm just focusing on that.
Well, you do it with your practice.
With everything. That's the most important thing. Thank you for bringing me off the golf course and back here.
Only you are the groundskeeper, the regulator, the police of what your practice is. So it doesn't matter what you think I'm doing or Kevin thinks what I'm doing.
Yep.
It's ultimately what I'm putting into it and what I'm, am I understanding the concepts and am I applying it?
Yeah.
And only I can be the final judge.
What a great point. Yeah. It really doesn't, there's not a lot of consequences to cheating at golf, except if you should look at it because it's a definition of your character. The devastating consequences are cheating at the Dhamma, whether we're involved in it or not. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, the Buddha keeps saying, so many sutras are, don't cheat on your Dhamma practice. Don't do this, do that. And a lot of what we talk about here is not cheating on our Dhamma practice. Don't substitute something because it's easier or it feels good or your best friends are doing it or your associates are doing it or you heard some Buddhist / psychologist give a podcast about some new visualization technique that's going to change the world. The Buddha taught one simple single method.
Perpetuates anatta.
It's just kind of grasping. Again, that doesn't. If you want to actually practice a Buddha's Dhamma, this is how you do it. Let me continue. Hoping for useful introspective insight. When the focus of insight is on external objects, events, views, and ideas, that lacks introspection. And what I'm referencing here also, remember I didn't mention this earlier. We are part of a larger sangha here. In other words, I'm not just teaching you. I'm mindful that there's quite a few people, millions online, that listen to me. Thousands, no. Hundreds, no. There's actually more people that listen to the video. There's actually more people to listen to the video Last week's, I think it was 23. Not life-changing, but the point is, then they're actually here. And I'm also teaching that audience, if you will. So that's maybe why I'm getting a little bit deep into this, but that's the point. Focusing on fabricated feelings and thoughts, lacking the proper framework and guidance of the Eightfold Path is not Dhamma practice. Those two last two lines, again, I'm talking to a larger audience as well. The modern Vipassana or insight movement, and I'm not putting it down, just to point out that even though they claim lineage all the way back to the Buddha, is something decidedly different than what a Buddha actually taught. And it's reflected in both their meditation method and what they hope to do in meditation, which is, and I've been on many retreats and I read, you know, quite a few books about that. I was interested in and practice it. They teach a similar meditation method, meaning mindfulness of the breath. But once you develop a measure of mindfulness of your breath, the instruction then is to look at your feelings and thoughts arising, and as a point of gaining insight, meaning analyze your feelings and thoughts and look at the impermanence of this and where did this come from. And that's not what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught to use meditation for one method, for one purpose, to deepen concentration. And in fact, when you read the Satipatthana Sutta and many others, the Buddha teaches what to do with feelings and thoughts. What do we do with feelings and thoughts as they arise and pass away? Come back to our breathing.
Yeah.
Period. No. Not try to figure out where they are, where they're coming from, what I'm going to do with them. Come back to the sensation of breathing. Why? Because they're just a distraction. It's the same. You're then substituting a meditation practice for what you normally do without a meditation practice, which is being preoccupied with your feelings and thoughts.
Exactly.
So it's when you look at it correctly, and again, not to denigrate a whole movement, but that's basically what they're teaching you to do, to validate something that the Buddha taught to simply dismiss. So that's why that's here, just to bring clarity to it, not to beat up anybody or any practice. This can only continue fabricated views now intentionally attached to an external projection of self clinging to ordinary phenomena, a deeply and profoundly distracted and debilitating quality of mind. It's the only thing that can follow from that. Siddhartha's profound breakthrough of understanding brought the realization that the problem of human suffering was the result of individual ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The whole Dhamma right there. He realized that no external force or fabricated Dharma could resolve individual ignorance. How could it? He realized that a mind rooted in ignorance will constantly cling to views that ignore this initial ignorance, the common internal feedback loop. So what I've encountered over many, many years in this practice is just that. The adapted, accommodated, and embellished practices provide the means for continued ignorance within the practice because they distract one out of their continually outside of their body and into a future state. Whatever that state is, the different practices define the state somewhat differently. But you know, a good example would be the Pure Land Buddhism that hopes to chant its way to, after death, to Amitabha Buddha heaven. That's wonderful. In fact, I did it for about 2 weeks. There's no teaching in how to understand myself in there, is it? I'm just chanting myself out of my life. It's fine if that's what I want to do as a practice, but it doesn't do anything for understanding, and it's not something the Buddha taught. But all of the non-Buddha taught Buddhist practices resolve themselves in a speculative non-physical realm, whether it's the realm of nothingness or emptiness or some type of heaven-like experience. The Buddha taught none of it. He taught how a human being can awaken in this lifetime. He wasn't concerned about a future life. The Buddha realized that every human being has only six properties that accurately describe a human being. He realized that making anything more of one's individual humanity is a fabricated attachment to the six properties and can only obscure the basic reality of a human being and lead to further craving for and clinging to fabricated realities. So that the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta, we mentioned dependent origination. This is just an introduction. So we're gonna study these actual suttas. We're gonna go back over dependent origination in 2 weeks. Again, in this context, we get to this, I think, in about 14 weeks. towards the end of our study, because we'll now understand it in a much deeper way, I think. We'll realize in a profound way what the Buddha taught every human being is. And he described it. If you're confused about what a self is, all you have to do is read this one sutta, and you'll find out and hopefully realize that every single human being is exactly the same. We're made up of the same elements. The four physical elements of earth, wind, fire, and water. The fifth element of space, that defines who we are. In other words, we couldn't hear anything if there wasn't a space for the sound to come in. We couldn't breathe if we didn't have this opening. The space property. And the animating and manifesting agent of consciousness, the sixth property. Which means that these other five properties are governed by that sixth, aren't they? And if that sixth property, the thing that is interpreting and interacting with the world, is fabricated, corrupted, it can only inform the rest of that form from that corrupted view, from that fabricated view. Again, it's simply another way of saying everything resolves within these six properties. And no matter what a human being does throughout their life, no matter what they acquire or don't acquire, no matter how they end up, no matter who their friends are, no matter how much power they have, or lack of power, or lack of friends, or a miserable ending, they cannot change that one thing, can it? The only thing we can ever be that is established is that. And where does all that resolve? In that sixth property of consciousness. So if we can learn what right mindfulness is, if we can develop a well-concentrated mind and develop the right mindfulness that sees things from right view, we've resolved all our issues. We're now living in reality. That's the whole Dhamma. Okay. As today, the common dharmas of the Buddha's... I use the word Dhamma when I'm referring directly to the Buddha's teaching. Dharma refers to any other Buddha's teaching that the Buddha didn't teach. As today, the common dharmas of the Buddha's time were presented in unique, divinely inspired, and dispensed, and similar, though culturally superior to all other dharmas. There's such a push today, and I think it's kind of an unconscious reaction to all the different Buddhist practices claiming to be the one true practice, that most of the modern teachers are saying, it's my practice is different, but it all resolves in the same thing. Ultimately, every practice ends up in the same. Of course, the Buddha taught something exactly different, and that's just another sleight of hand to continue to ignore ignorance. It sounds good. In fact, this whole idea of a one world, one universe consciousness, a non-dual reality where we're all one thing, it sounds great, doesn't it? That was the thinking since I grew up. I grew up in the age of Aquarius. The promise of the age of Aquarius is that we're at some point we're going to evolve into this one great singular consciousness. It sounds wonderful. And maybe it's possible, but it's not something that's very practical right now. In fact, the Buddha taught, rather than see everything as one thing, he taught to see everything in its, I'll use the word that I would use, is exquisite diversity. Because when we stop insisting that everything is me by creating this one world, non-dual view, then I can see everything in its exquisite diversity as it really is. Is that clear? That's such an important point. We're not all one thing. We're all part of this one universe, but so what? But that has nothing to do with the Dhamma. What we need to understand is if we're going to live in peace and conflict-free, we have to understand who we are. Superior to all other Dharmas. Rooted in ignorance and prone to continual fabrications, these Dharmas, then and now, would often claim that all dharmas reach the same culmination of some sort of vague universal understanding or salvation from this physical world through self-establishment and escape in fabricated and speculative non-physical realms. There's so many suttas, we've been through them all the time, where the Buddha cautions against doing just that. Just like today, this form of compulsive non-dual thinking encourages picking and choosing bits of different fabricated dharmas, creating a personalized and further fabricated personal dharma. In fact, the most common refrain you hear in modern Buddhism, and it's another one of those accommodations to all the different contradictory practices, is to pick and choose what you like out of this practice and that practice and this method and that discipline. Take what you like out of it and make your own Dharma practice. In fact, that's the most common refrain. Take a little bit of Zen, a little bit of Tibetan, a little bit of Theravadan, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Mix in some modern pop psychology and maybe incorporate jogging and once a week fast running because somebody said it's helpful. And there's your Dharma practice. The problem is, and I spent many, many years in these alternative Buddhist practices, and I never, ever heard, except very rarely, I mean, incredibly infrequently, for a Noble Truth or an Eightfold Path. It's simply not part of the practice. When that's the, and I never heard dependent origination presented at all, really. I never heard an exposition, even a confused one, just being called, everything is interdependent, we're all interdependently co-arising. It has nothing to do with what the Buddha taught.
Not that you would be happy. But you won't ever get to the understanding of what causes suffering.
It's a fabricated happiness, because I felt all that time, and I was going into some of the, you know, the major monasteries, listening to some of the greatest teachers that we have, not great, the most recognized teachers, beautiful places, being a part of their local sangha. And I always felt good at the end of one of these, you know, sessions or a retreat, but I was also always frustrated. And there, that subtle tension was, you know, I still don't get what they're talking about. But the carrot is, keep coming. It's going to take endless lifetimes to do it, but you're doing the right thing. And it was so frustrating and confusing until I came to what the Buddha taught. And he taught me that, yes, I'm teaching you, something that you can use in this lifetime right here, right now, which was his only concern. This unfocused trance-like grasping ignores the very Dhamma that provides liberation from ignorance. This type of grasping after Dhamma practice was common during the Buddha's lifetime and continues today with modern Buddhism by common agreement. That's just, you don't think you'll hear that anyplace else. Somebody asked me if anybody else teaches like this. It's the first time I've heard that phrase, but it fits. Buddhism by common agreement, because that's what it is. It's that pick and choose. Take a little bit from column A, a little bit from column B, and put it together and call it a practice. The Buddha taught something very specific, very direct, that does not take to adaptation, accommodation, or embellishment at all. Siddhartha found the dharmas of his time common, uninspiring, confusing, distracting, and without substance. He found these dharmas heavily influenced not by introspective insight, insightful knowledge, but by unexamined blind faith, culture, class, hierarchy, and unproven and unprovable imaginary supernatural abstractions. All fabricated dharmas offered some form of salvation or taught complete annihilation, with misguided doctrines of emptiness, nothingness, and similar non-dual trance-based imaginary self-establishments, none of which resolve in an individual current human life. That's obvious, isn't it? When my focus is to how do I fix this self by establishing a fabricated self in some non-physical realm, I've lost everything, haven't I? Because now the most important thing isn't what's going on with me right now, it's what's going to be going on with me when I achieve that fabricated state. And so you spend your whole life preparing yourself through chanting, bowing, whatever it might be, continued ignorance, that can only establish yourself in a future state of ignorance. That's all that can possibly happen from a mind rooted in ignorance, isn't it? And that points to, the immediacy of the Buddha's Dhamma. In this moment, whatever view I'm holding of myself is going to frame and influence whatever my experience is. And so if my mind is still rooted, in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, then I'm going to interpret what's occurring in my mind, in this body, from that view rooted in ignorance. If my mind is well concentrated and framed by the Eightfold Path, then in this moment, I will interpret and respond to what's occurring from right view, and my mind will remain conflict-free. And so this moment, in each and every moment of our lives, holds the potential to awaken. We shouldn't waste it. And how do we do that? How do we make the most out of each moment? we do the best we can within the framework of the Eightfold Path. And if we have integrated the Eightfold Path and we're doing the best we can, we also have this inner assurance and inner poise that we are doing all that we can. And no matter how we find our present level of mindfulness, we'll be at peace with it because we know where we're going. And that is a peace and calm that comes prior to awakening. It comes from practicing the Eightfold Path and developing right mindfulness. In contrast to that, if I'm clinging to ignorant views, then this moment holds the only potential for developing further ignorant views. That's the most important teaching on karma and rebirth. It has nothing to do with future lives. And we're going to get to that later on in the study. This next and last section is called Liberation from Ignorance. Siddhartha understood that fabricated self-referential views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths could only further ignorance and the stress and suffering that is, listen to the words, that is dependent on origination in this initial ignorance, dependent origination. He realized that he was seeking understanding where no understanding could be found. So no matter how charismatic, brilliant, sincere any teacher might be, if they're not teaching something where understanding can be found, they can't teach it. I can't learn from Tommy how to change the oil in a car. Well, he might be able to teach me, but if Tommy doesn't understand that, he's a brilliant dance teacher. He's got a lot to offer. But if I'm not interested in learning dance, but I like Tommy, I'm going to be completely frustrated and disappointed by what he can teach me, aren't I? Nobody can teach something that they don't have to teach, including a Dhamma teacher. That's why we have teacher training. He was seeking understanding where no understanding could be found. Once formed in ignorance, a mind will grasp after and cling tenaciously to fabricated views despite the confusion, distraction, and ongoing unsatisfactory experience. Why would a mind keep doing that? It's kind of a form of self-sabotage because it's familiar and that mind doesn't know anything else to do. It's never been shown. This self-inflicted, discontented quality of mind will continually grasp after contentment where contentment cannot be found. And continued fabricated experiences and so-called fabricated so-called insight. Siddhartha's breakthrough of understanding resulted in his profound right view that it is due to a misunderstood and fabricated view of self in relation to the world that results in all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing and stressful experiences. One incredibly long sentence that, again, just talks about and references the three marks of existence. It is the stressful relationship between a fabricated self craving continual establishment in an impermanent environment that Siddhartha's breakthrough of understanding coalesced on. In other words, the point of that sentence is he didn't escape the condition of his ignorance. He resolved ignorance within that conditioned mind. And that's what this brilliant man taught us, that we can do the same thing. Many of you have often said, heard me say that if you're going to interact with someone in a meaningful way, you have to meet people where they are. This Dhamma is just the same way, but focused inwardly. We have to meet ourselves where we are. At whatever level of ignorance we are at, we have to first acknowledge it because that's where we are. That saying that I use often, if you're in New York and you want to get to Los Angeles, but you think you're in Chicago, you can't get there. So the first aspect of the Dhamma is putting ourselves in our place. That's why that meditation method that the Buddha taught is so important, because every time we're mindful of our breath, even if it's just for a moment, we have in that moment united a mind in its body where it can now do some good. This well-focused insight is the culmination of his search for understanding. Rather than continuing his distracting grasping after the speculative results of severe asceticism or craving for and clinging to the speculative and imaginary non-dual doctrines common to his time and ours, this brilliant and courageous man realized that all common spiritual pursuits only encourage continued ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Continued ignorance of Four Noble Truths could only continue distraction, confusion, delusion, and ongoing disappointing life experiences. Siddhartha understood that all of these fabricated doctrines required an ongoing trance-like state induced by the fabricated beliefs associated with a particular doctrine. Again, it's just describing how we keep manufacturing this feedback loop in even so-called spiritual pursuits. This self-induced trance-like state is obscured by the fabricated doctrines that encourage continued ignorance. By first validating the view of self as needing salvation, wrong view, and then providing salvation through typical means of the beliefs themselves, including hybrid meditation methods, distracting insight, rites, rituals, and ascetic practices, hoping to gain notice and favor from a personalized arbitrary spiritual system activated by blind devotion, seeking direct favor from more advanced or more accomplished gods and other supernatural beings. I'm going to submit that sentence to Guinness for the world's longest sentence. Excuse me for that. Did that make sense to anyone? To everyone? It simply means that, again, the point I keep making, that there's no external system or belief that can resolve ignorance, save examining or having a vehicle to recognize and abandon that ignorance. And again, that's the whole point of the Eightfold Path. It does nothing to get us looking outside of ourselves or into the future. It does everything about uniting that mind in a body where it can do some good. These doctrines then and now provide a convenient mindless distraction within the doctrine itself from life as life occurs. Siddhartha realized that constantly seeking salvation through speculative and impossible to experience future rewards or non-physical self-establishments in mystical realms of nothingness and emptiness arose from the compulsive need to ignore the reality of ongoing ignorance. In other words, the reason why we continue ignorance is included in the word itself. It's the nature of ignorance to ignore, especially to ignore its own ignorance, because that's the way a mind rooted in ignorance can continue to ignore its own ignorance, on and on and on, maintaining that feedback loop. The doctrines that Siddhartha studied, mastered, and discarded were primarily based on the Vedas, the doctrinal foundation for modern Hinduism. As described in the Arya Parayasana Sutta and in the numerous suttas on rite meditation or jhana meditation, seeking this constant distraction from reality through a fabricated and speculative dharma practice, does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, or to unbinding. Again, continuing with the Buddha's words, this dharma only seeks to establish a reappearance in the dimension of nothingness or infinite space or infinite consciousness or neither perception or non-perception. And that list could go on and on. What the Buddha is referring to is any speculative or fabricated non-physical realm. And that line that is right here is presented in many, many suttas. The Buddha's saying just that. Get your mind out of the future, out of magic and mystical teachings and esoteric teachings and future fabricated self-establishments and non-physical realms, and bring it back to right here, right now, where it can do some good. When seen in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, most modern Buddhist religions, hybrid practices, and lineages have more in common with the Vedic-based Hindu practices Siddhartha dismissed, as they lack the clarity and the true introspective focus for his awakening. And that is nearly 100% of modern Buddhism culminates in some aspect of this non-dual thinking. And that's the primary tenet. And again, I'm not putting down Hinduism. It's a wonderful religion worldwide, still very vibrant and viable. It's just not this. That is a basic Hindu practice, a Hindu belief, that all things resolve in, I'm going to be very brief. This is a very brief and synopsized. All things resolve in Atta, in Brahma, the great creator, almost like the Christian belief, very similar to that. And the Buddha says, no, that's not it. And even if it was true, he didn't say it's not true or it is true. He says it's simply a complete distraction from who you are as a human being right here, right now. The common philosophical thread of most of the spiritual philosophies of ordinary human construction reflects this convenient distraction from ignorance provided by the underlying philosophy itself. This common distraction is convenient to a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, craving for any method of preserving its own ignorant or wrong views. I'm going to talk more about that as the consequences of following wrong views as a practice, but we'll get more into that as we develop our course. Many who feel a lack of understanding of human life or a pervasive lack of meaning in their lives will seek out doctrinal philosophies that provide the appearance of a spiritual practice, but in relation to the Buddha's Dhamma, only distract the mind outside of its own body by clinging to fabricated beliefs while hoping for insight or salvation from this underlying fabrication. In other words, we create the experience that we need salvation, and like I mentioned before, but then we seek salvation where it can't be found, in more fabricated views. Whether the goal or culmination of a doctrine is insight into fleeting thoughts and feelings or self-establishment in a vague Buddhist heaven or any non-physical and non-dual realm through any external means contradicts the Buddha's Dhamma. An external means is any practice that seeks to establish itself in any state other than the present human state. Makes sense, doesn't it? Why would I want to be anything? I mean, when I start understanding the nature of reality, why would I want to be or insist on being something that I can't be? Six properties. A typical non-dual philosophy is any belief system that resolves in a common non-physical environment. Non-dual philosophies seek to reinforce the underlying and often ignored non-dual view common to all religious and spiritual philosophies. And again, I always have to say, I'm not against religion. I'm not putting it down. You can practice any type of religion you want and still practice the Buddha's Dhamma. The problem comes when you try to combine the two and make it one thing. Non-dual philosophies look for understanding within fabricated views that resolve in a common repository for self in a vague, nondescript environment of nothingness or emptiness, or as a common universal reward for proper behavior. The Buddha's Dhamma finds no value in these distracting pursuits. The Buddha's Dhamma directly develops insight through introspection into what one is mindful of. Hold in mind what's occurring within our bodies and within our minds. Mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. If what is held in mind is seen by a mind continually distracted by speculative dharmas, no useful and skillful introspective insight is possible. If what is held in mind is framed by the Eightfold Path, then useful and skillful introspective insight is possible and likely. An authentic Dhamma practice is framed by the Eightfold Path. The meditation method taught within this framework is jhana. The insight developed is a specifically introspective insight into the clinging relationship between ignorant views of self in relation to physical phenomena resulting in stress and suffering. Again, another reference to the three marks of existence. We're almost done. We are all fortunate indeed that the Buddha's Dhamma in its pure form continues to be available, highly relevant, and highly effective in developing useful and skillful insight into anicca, anatta, hold on a second, please. Anatta and dukkha in an unwavering, calm, and peaceful mind. Thank you for listening to this long introduction today. It's gotten a little bit late. It's 7 minutes to 10. Does anybody have to run out? You got anybody on a schedule? Tommy, is that you? Tell me what you think, Tommy.
I think I'm a big sponge. Big sponge, that's what I am. I'm just absorbing as I can absorb. And I continue to.
I'm glad you're here. There's a lot of information. Remember, this is just a broad exposition of what we're going to be covering. And now we'll get to it and explain this all. So I'm glad you came. Regina, what did you think about our class? I know most of this was out of context, but I didn't hurt your head, did I?
That's it. I'm trying to be the sponge, but
just little sponges.
Yeah. It's good to have a moment to, just breathe.
Yeah. There was a lot of information. And one of the things that a human mind wants to do is think that it has to get everything that's thrown at it. That's not the case. Really, this is just to imprint on all of our minds where we're going. But we don't need to think much more about it past that. All things will be made clear as we continue to go along. If you're interested in continuing this meditation method, and I hope you do, on my website, Tommy can point you to it, but it's becoming-buddha.com. At the top of the first screen, you'll see a sign that said Guided Jhana Meditations. If you click on that, you'll be taken to another page that has recorded meditations, just like we did here, from 5 to 45 minutes. So you can use that to start a meditation practice. And the other thing that I'll remind you is that meditation is part of this bigger practice that we talk about here. And then to start slowly, maybe with just a 5-minute meditation. And if you can do that twice a day, and come to class when you can and keep talking to Tommy, you'll have a great meditation practice. So I'm glad you came today. I'm glad Tommy was here. So whenever you need to leave, feel free to go. We'll go around the room and briefly see what we have to say. I'll see you soon, Tommy.
Thank you.
Take care, Regina. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, you know, it's a vast talk, obviously, or a large talk, but I liked how the three Dhammapada talks sort of led into this, and there was meaning in those. You know, the Malabhaga Sutta explained to be an island unto yourself. I think you clarified a lot of that with this talk, that you know, this is an inward focus, and it really needs to be inside. You know, it's not out there. It's not where you're going to be. That's attaching to the world. And I liked what David said about, you know, and just that's that rightly self-awakened, rightly self-awakened path the Buddha described, the island unto yourself. And I like what David said about, you know, the groundskeeper, obviously that touched on something about the underbrush of desire. And, you know, that's that inward job we have to do. And I even was thinking about, you know, groundskeeper or even a greenskeeper. You know, the greenskeeper cuts a grass very low, so grass is like a pool table, so a ball can roll over it. And in that metaphor, it's like, you know, there's no desire. If there's desire, there's a snag. The ball, you can't roll through, because your desire is often confusing, I think. I think a lot of people hang up on that word. It doesn't mean you can't desire to take a piece of your cake when it's in front of you. But really, when you look at the word desire and what I think the Buddha is saying, it's really what it is craving. You know, when you're craving, that's where you're going to establish that wrong view of self, anatta, and start the loop all over again. So we have to be diligent and, you know, trim the grounds, keep the grass low, so there's less friction.
Excellent. Yeah, friction is another word for stress, isn't it? And as we develop profound right view, because we have now resolved our clinging to impermanent phenomena, we're not entangled in the world. That's what that means. You've heard me use that word often too. And so if we're not entangled in the world, there's nothing in the world to upset us, to get us distracted, to have us need anything to be any different than it is, because I'm not identified with it. And you just move on into the next moment. Smooth, like a good putt. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning, all sitting noble
family. I'm glad you're here. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. So I'm going to restrain from some of the stuff I want to say, but what I did want to, because I think that I should spend more time on this, because dependent origination is, in my view, it sounds simple, but it's huge, because that part of the self that you were mentioning earlier, you know, impermanence we can kind of grasp, and dukkha we can kind of grasp, but it's the self, right? The ego. That the moment we're born, humans have. I mean, you know, a dog doesn't get insulted, you know, and animals don't get insulted. They may be conditioned. They may be conditioned, you know, if they behave. But we have egos. We have the self. And it's a tricky, it's a nefarious thing. You know, it tricks you, and it looks for your weakness.
Yes.
And it for me, in my Dhamma practice, as I go about my day, the self-referential views that we all feel when a car cuts us off, or when a client maybe raises their voice at you, or you feel like you should have done better, right? These are all ego-based, self-based issues.
Yeah.
So where I am now, I think about enlightenment and everything, and I'm like, no. But just to be able to recognize, you know, that rising mm-hmm. of that feeling mm-hmm. is enough to get back to the breath and keep calm. And I think we can all find that when we do that, better decisions are made, a more tranquil and peaceful life is, or day is, you know, happens. And so this, you know, discussion today had a lot of, you know, that's just one part of it. Just a little part of it. And all those other things that wrap around it. So I know that was long-winded, but from there I'm going to restrain further, because I find this very, you know, helpful. So, thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Yeah, again, just a reminder, this is just an introduction. So the rest of the course, the rest of the course is going to explain what I introduced today. And did anybody else have any difficulty understanding and applying dependent origination?
It changes.
It's the primary teaching. It actually is so simple, but it's so close to us that we can't see it until we develop the context. So I think it's the second or third week that's part of this course, is going through dependent origination with the focus that look at how this relates to the three marks of existence. So, and I probably teach dependent origination in one form or another at least three or four times a year, because it's really the foundation for everything. Mm-hmm. So the more you come, the more you'll understand how it applies. But basically, dependent origination says ignorance of Four Noble Truths results in suffering. So the resolution of that is understanding Four Noble Truths. It points directly to that. So, glad you're here. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning, John. I think I'm going to exercise noble silence.
Yeah, a lot
I
of
do
people
have to leave in a few minutes, but I think I can hang in until the end.
Okay, we'll try to get to it. Glad you're here. Good morning, Eva. Glad you're here. David?
I just look forward to the upcoming classes and all the input everyone has. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Brett.
Good to be here. Thanks for the teaching. I'm going to keep coming and get reacquainted with the Eightfold Path and Four Noble Truths from the basics. And thanks.
Thank you. I'm glad you're here. Yeah, I mean, that's just it. It is the basics. I mean, the whole teaching, the whole Dhamma is basic. You know, you always hear me say there's nothing advanced. It's just that we start developing this basic understanding of who we are in relation to the world. Thank you. Good morning, Becky.
Good morning, John. Very nice to be here. I'm so glad you're doing this, because it's just, again, bringing concepts that have been difficult for me back into focus. And even after listening to you today, I feel like I have a better understanding of the relationship between anatta and anicca and dukkha.
Good.
But dependent origination is still a giant ball of fuzz.
It is for.
And so I'm looking forward to work to having more discussions.
Yeah, thank you. One of the reasons why we have trouble incorporating something is because we don't understand the why. Like, how does this fit? Why am I even considering something like from ignorance to blah blah blah?
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be easier to understand, I think, in a few weeks when we get to it, because you'll continue to see how it fits into these three marks of existence. Right. How to apply this teaching from the abstract to an experience, to a personal experience. That's how the Buddha's Dhamma is Ahipasika. You have to come and see, you have to experience it. But of course, as we learn, human beings learn first in the abstract, don't we, no matter what it is.
Right.
Even if it's how to bake bread, until you actually bake bread, it's still an abstract thought.
Exactly.
Thank you. Good morning, Kevin.
It's a great teaching. To me, it's almost like a reintroduction. It's a synopsis of, you know, where you've been and where I've been, with even where we've all been in the past almost 3 years I've been coming here. And now it's sort of like a reintroduction. It's like recasting where we're going and a deeper understanding of it.
Yeah. Thank you. That really is the idea. This is not a series of teachings with this particular focus that I could have given here, I think I wouldn't have a couple of years ago, because as a Sangha, we don't we hadn't yet developed a proper framework, but we have. You're all understanding, even though there's more to integrate. You understand where I'm going, and that is remarkable, because these are not there's nothing advanced here, but it does take a foundational understanding to make this useful, and you're all applying it, and it will simply become more clear. You could look at it this way: as a sangha, we went from knowing nothing to now understanding, even in a general way, dependent origination. And you described this pretty good, kind of how do I practice it? And now we're going to know. We're going to understand in a very well-focused way. The Dhamma is practiced right here, right now. The Dhamma resolves right here, right now. And it cannot in any other way. But it does very, I'm going to say easily, very effectively. Once we can unite a mind in its body and put aside ignorance, we're free. So, again, if you haven't heard last Tuesday's class, please catch up to part one of this. And then again, as we go forward, the Tuesdays and Saturday classes are going to be on different subjects. So I hope you can either come to class or catch up during the week. You don't want to miss it. You don't miss the coming attractions. So, we'll finish with... it's not that. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditation posture. And again, gently close your eyes, gently close your mouths, and just take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.